Those are the beautiful chord progressions that signal the beginning of Gaza Corner. And tonight will be I think, a pretty special Gaza Corner. Israel does really all it can to hide the reality of its military occupation because Israel fears, I think, more than anything, if masses of people, or especially if politicians were to see for themselves the consequences of its 55-year military occupation for themselves, I think world opinion would turn against Israel in a profound way. It's not easy to access the belly of the beast of the occupation. Israel makes it difficult. And the belly of the beast of the occupation is the systemic daily settler violence abetted by Israeli security forces against Palestinians, most notably in the areas of Masafayata, which is also known as the South Hebron Hills, and the Jordan Valley in the illegally occupied West Bank. The Israeli High Court, since its inception, which goes back to the creation of Israel in 1948, has been an essential tool to entrench the occupation and facilitate ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the latest evidence, the latest reminder, was quite recent. On May 4th, Israel's High Court approved one of the largest forcible transfers of Palestinians from their land since 1967. I did a Gaza Corner on it on May 7th. You can go to tangents.com and in the left-hand column, just click on the Gaza Corner archive and scroll to the May 7th segment. The audio, the summary, all the source articles are there. Well over 1,000 Palestinian residents of 8 herding communities in Masafayata are being, or at least facing, forced displacement by Israeli forces. It's a blatant violation of the 1949 Geneva Convention. It states, quote, "Individual or mass forcible transfers, as well as deportations of protected persons from occupied territory to the territory of the occupying power or to that of any other country, occupied or not, are prohibited, regardless of their motive," unquote. Israel's High Court said that when international law contradicts Israeli law prevails. International law is subservient to Israeli law. So it's been about 2 months since the ethnic cleansing directive came down, and to get the latest on the Palestinians facing forced displacement from areas they've lived since well before the creation of Israel, we are very fortunate to have via Zoom the longstanding and never-ending Bay Area-based human rights activist Jim Haber, who just returned from the heart of Masafayata, where the forced expulsion is occurring. So, Jim, welcome. Ah, hold on. Let me do it again. Jim, welcome.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
I pressed the wrong button.
It
So
happens.
it does. So the forced displacement and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the illegally occupied West Bank has been going on, as I said, for 55 years. Jim, you've seen it firsthand now in the South Hebron Hills 4 times in the last 6 years. As part of the Center for Jewish Nonviolence delegations, I imagine a lot of change, and sadly, change for the worse has happened in that time. What are those changes that you've observed in terms of settler violence and forced displacement in the South Hebron Hills, also known as Masafayata?
I think the first thing I noticed was driving south out of Jerusalem, past Bethlehem and Hebron, and the immense construction for roads and other infrastructure all the way south. It's like so many illegal occupiers have moved in to the area that there's a full-on commute now. Like, we were doing reverse commute going to the South Hebron Hills from Jerusalem and then back. And so it was really noticeable. And this huge tunnel leaving Jerusalem, it was really breathtaking, the growth of the roads and infrastructure. The illegal outposts all have large, low, white-roofed industrial buildings, like many, I think, for chicken coops or other, you know, animal husbandry, but also for other industry, in addition to the red roofs that are ubiquitous for the illegal outposts but and Jim, settlements.
Jim, can you distinguish between, because settlements are illegal under international law, for people who don't understand the distinction between a settlement and a illegal outpost when both are illegal?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to get too lost in the distinction right now because I think they're all illegal and offensive. But the settlements that are tend to be called settlements are legal under Israeli law, but considered illegal under international law. Then in addition, there are these outposts, which can be significant in size, but they're technically illegal under Israeli law as well, although the Israeli government and military and police don't treat them as illegal at all.
Yeah, they hook them up to electricity and plumbing and everything else that they would need. And is it fair to say...
And water.
And water. And is it fair to say that the illegal outposts are generally younger in age, much younger, and much, much more violent and intent on attacking Palestinians, both Palestinians themselves, their livestock, burning their trees, whatever it takes to try to intimidate them to leave?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's, I don't want to only blame the younger ones, sorry. You know, I know that when we were at this demonstration, it was outside of Mitzpah Yair, where the illegal residents have been blocking a road that goes into this firing zone in Masa Furyata. So they've been blocking this road that, again, Israel, the country, says this road should be open. And even though Palestinians aren't supposed to live in this area, they do. And this road's supposed to be open, but the illegal residents block it. And it was old residents that were coming out and being as present when we were trying to clear the rocks, about 300 of us. It wasn't just the younger ones coming out. And in Umm el-Khair, I know that Auda told us a story that the kids were playing soccer and three settler kids, like, they were starting to play. And, you know, a parent or a grandparent came out and, you know, called our friends a terrorist and told their kids to, you know, get out of there, you know. So the outposts, I think, may largely be younger, but not only.
I hear you. So talk about the work that you, either the work or what you observed, what your expectation was and what happened as part of this delegation. I mean, you were there to see what's going on with the single largest expulsion of Palestinians since 1967.
Yeah. But just a couple of other things about changes. You know, I visited Susia and Tuwani and Umm el-Khair, and then some other smaller villages in the firing zone. And in each place, I have to say that despite the demolitions that happen against them, they've improved the quality of their own lives. And despite the destruction and the surrounding by these infiltrators, they've also done improvements, you know, the community center and playground. They're kind of small things, but they're real and significant, and that it's not only the offensive. I mean, it was overwhelming, the growth of the offensive colonizers. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that our people are resilient and that they're also beautifying their lives, even though they may face demolition orders. So it's really important to note that. One other change, the infrastructure, like internet, everyone has good internet now. It used to be down in that area, it was 2G or 3G on the last trip there, beginning of right before COVID. So it was interesting. We got the benefit of that also. Now on this trip, each time we do like a couple of days of work where we're really trying to be helpful in projects that the Palestinian friends have, you know, come up with that they've asked us to do. And then there's usually a day where we're doing similar work, but it also makes a political point where we try to get more international airplay and media. And so we were focused on repairing roads because it's expensive to, for teachers with cars. The roads are so bad and the settlers make it worse, but they're also rough roads. And so it's expensive to get water in and for the doctors to travel and teachers. These roads are really important. So we fixed up some roads a bit, and then we made a big show about how settlers are blocking this road that's supposed to be open. According to Israeli law, it's supposed to be open. It's illegal for them to block it. But, you know, the police stopped us from opening the road by moving these boulders out of the way while the people that put the boulders there to begin with were joking with the police. So that's kind of what we were doing there. We also spent some time, either some parts of our group on another day, we went into Jerusalem and saw how the dispossession in Jerusalem takes similar but unique forms also in neighborhoods in Jerusalem. We also spent some time.
I want to read a quote to you from a person I imagine that you know, Ali Awad, the human rights activist and writer from the village of Atuba in the South Hebron Hills in Musafayata. He actually has a degree in English literature, and I think he's currently getting his master's in English at Al-Quds University. His quote is, "What is happening now," and he's talking about the South Hebron Hills, after this high court order of expulsion, "what is happening now is clearly a policy of slow expulsion. They're not arriving with trucks to deport us en masse, but the end goal is exactly the same." Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, Ali, he's an inspiring person. You know, things are shifting and you don't know where they're going to go. There's some people who wake up early every morning to see if they see army movement, tanks or bulldozers moving somewhere, or who's gotten a notice. And then people come out and try to be as supportive as possible, you know, all around the area. And people rebuild those. So it's sort of like they just make it really hard. But it is increasing. And with this court ruling, and then, you know, the army did a couple weeks or just last week, they moved in a way that they hadn't before, you know, scaring sheep. And a great someone from Tawani, Basil Adra. You can see his stuff on 972 magazine and sometimes on Al Jazeera Plus and elsewhere. But he had video up recently that just, you could see these tanks just scaring these sheep. And he said that they were right next to a school. And there's no reason these people shouldn't be treated like a military opponent. They're not militarized in any way. And they're just living simple lives. They want electricity and all these nice things, but they're okay with their simplicity in other regards. You know, they're not a military threat. And so to threaten them with such military violence is just really stunning and an affront to all that's good.
Well, Jim, I think it's important to talk about these military firing zones. They're not justified on military grounds. They are done as a mechanism to displace Palestinians. And in the case of Musafayata, you have to go back to 1981, when the firing zone designation occurred. Ariel Sharon was then Israel's agriculture minister, the very same Ariel Sharon who became defense minister, was responsible for the Sabra and Shatila Palestinian massacres in Lebanon in 1982, and then got rewarded by becoming prime minister of Israel later on. Sharon, not a general, not someone in the military, it was Sharon as agriculture minister who was the one who designated it a military zone. That's a disconnect to me. Why would an agriculture minister do it, not a military person? And then years later, it became public that Sharon admitted in 1981 that the area was declared a firing zone for the purpose of displacing Palestinians from their land so it could be seized by Israel. I'm going to excerpt briefly from Haaretz, the newspaper in Israel. Quote, in a joint committee meeting for settler affairs on July 12, 1981, attended by Israeli government and World Zionist Organization representatives, the committee's chairman and then agriculture minister, Ariel Sharon, told the IDF, that's the Israeli Defense Force representative, that, quote, additional training areas must be closed in at the border between the bottom of the Hebron Hills and the Judean Desert. In other words, Masafer Yatta, in order to stop the spreading of the Arab villagers on the mountainside toward the desert, unquote. And then soon after his proclamation, firing zone 918 was born. It was born not for a military reason, but expressly to evict, to displace forcibly these Palestinians. And all these years later, now the Israeli High Court has said, you can do it.
Well, you know, in 2017, we helped the Center for Jewish Nonviolence on our big action day was we helped some residents from Sarura who were kicked out of the firing zone back in 1997, reopen their caves and clean them out and, you know, start using them. The youth of Samud, Samud means steadfastness in Arabic. It's a very important word. Youth of Samud have been using those caves. No, great activist Sami Harani was arrested just last week, but he was freed, but they've confiscated the car. But so the displacements happened before, but, you know, people moved back in. But right now, because it is officially a military firing zone, they could start acting like it really is, you know, so they haven't, but it seemed like last week, like they're gearing up to make like they want to have exercises. And so that it's scary. Another friend from St. Louis who's still there said that people are pensive. People are really pensive.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of links at the Tangents playlist at tangents.com and they scroll down to the Gaza Corner section. Thanks to Harry, the playlist guru, for posting them. But I was going to read a fairly long excerpt. Because we don't have time, I'm not going to do it. But if you are interested in really learning how the Israelis are doing everything they can to make it almost, I mean, it would be impossible, speaking for myself, if all of a sudden my home was destroyed, I had no access to water, very little access to food, my livelihood was taken away from me. In this case, they herd sheep. I probably leave, right? This is what they're trying to do, but they don't want to do it so blatantly as forcing them onto trucks and taking them away because that's such a bad image. But if they make life so impossible for them so people leave, they can get away with this slow ethnic cleansing. And there's an article that was written by Ali Awad. It's one of the linked articles. The headline is, they're not arriving with trucks to deport us, but the goal is the same. That is a phenomenal article written by Ali Awad. Jim, you were there. I think you were there when there was the settler attack, the settler throwing the rock through the window of an activist's car who was just parked there trying to leave. Can you talk about that attack and also how that maybe leads into how laws differ for settlers and Palestinians and internationalists?
Sure. During the course when we were there, settlers stole sheep, you know, stole a lamb. Our lunch was late one day because they went to try to help this sheep herder get his lamb back, but they threatened to arrest the sheep herder. So this one, the action day, there were maybe 300 Palestinians, Israeli activists, and internationals, us and others. And we wanted to move these boulders, and then the police was there pretty much right away, and they were pushing us back. It was the most tear gas I've ever had. I think our 4th of July explosions here are scarier than the stun grenade flashbangs that they use there. That was interesting. But the tear gas is scary, and just the viciousness of the pushing.
Is this when you were injured?
Yeah, and so I was knocked down. Other people were hurt. My thigh is still a little bit tender, my left thigh, but it's fine. You know, I am okay. And other people get it worse, but you know, obviously, you know, it's not about me. But yeah, it was, I don't know, meaningful to be there and stand with people and be a line of resistance, and come back and talk about the people there. And
but what happened? Tell us about that.
As I mentioned before, this outpost puts rocks and boulders in this road, and we were trying to clear it. And so then the police, you know, people would mill around quite a bit, even Issa Amro getting these canopies that we brought for shade and going where the police were. So there were times of not confrontation, but there was always the threat. And then they would unleash and push us back up the road. And then we had to ultimately walk over hills to a road away from Mizpeh Yair. Mizpeh Yair is on the west side of the west edge of the firing zone, just on the outside. So we were at this road trying to get increased access for doctors and teachers and water to get into the firing zone to help people. And so a couple people were arrested. These two Israelis were arrested who had been around, and then they were released, as I understand it, they were being released right in front of the entrance to the outpost. And
when you say two Israelis, you mean two Israeli activists?
Yes, two Israeli activists who were with us, who were trying to open this road too. No reason they should have been arrested, I don't think. You know, but they were detained, they were being released, they were in their car, and then another vehicle blocked their exit, and then this man from the outpost threw a good-sized rock through the driver's side window and injured the driver, the woman on her face. She had to go to the hospital. You know, it was very intense, but they're okay. And it does seem like there, you know, there is a case going forward. And so, yeah, it's in part because they're Israeli, because violence against Palestinians is pretty much unpunished. It really is. And even, I mean, people have been writing about it in pretty stark terms in Israel and in Palestine. But here it's harder to talk about that and get away with it in the media or in public discourse. But there, a little bit more. I mean, there's a lot of ignorance there on the part of Jewish Israelis about what actually is going on with Palestinians. Peace with Palestinians and resolution of the problem is low on their priority list compared to most things. But there is awareness. So there is some awareness at the same time.
Let me add that the settler who threw the rock and the police were right there did not go after him. They let him go.
Right.
And it was only because video of this attack occurred and a photograph was widely disseminated online. This got a lot of publicity because it hit an Israeli activist. It would have gotten a lot of publicity if it hit an internationalist as well, but not so if it had hit a Palestinian.
Yeah, that's part of the racism, the whole thing, and the whole thing about privilege and trying to leverage privilege in a you know, as useful way as possible.
But the police did finally locate and arrest this attacker. We'll see, you know, we'll see what happens. But it was only because it was caught on video. In the few minutes that we have left, in just like 3 or 4 minutes. There's a link that you wanted me to remind you to talk about, so I want to do that, and that's humansofmasafayata.substack.com, which is linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's still small, and there is an Instagram, Humans of Masafayata. It's a storytelling project that some people in the area, young people, activists, have started, and they're trying to get it to grow. So if you're on Instagram, or you can find the Substack has some of the stories there. I'm not on Instagram, so I follow that. But if you're on Instagram, definitely do whatever you can there. Humans of Masafayata, and you'll see people's stories and more will be emerging soon. So go there and try to follow that if you can.
Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is something that I really care deeply about, and that is how criticism of Israel somehow, I'm not going to talk about how that is somehow turned around into anti-Semitism, but what I do want to do is distinguish between people who have Jewish values yet are critical of Israel. And I'm not sure you know this person, but I imagine you do. She is an activist in CJNV, Center for Jewish Nonviolence, and her name is Lizzie Horn Moses. She's a rabbinical student from Philadelphia. Do you know her?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what she said. She said, quote, "It is a moral obligation of rabbis and future rabbis to be standing against the occupation. The oppression by the Israeli government, the military, and the settlers here in Masafer Yatta is all happening in our name. As a leader in the Jewish community, it is my duty to stand up and say that this is inhumane and cannot be done in the name of our community," unquote. So I'd like to ask you, Jim, is it becoming more commonplace to find Jewish organizations, Jewish congregations, welcoming anti-Zionist Jews?
It's still a tough sell, but there is some space opening up. I did join Kehila in 2016 after the other, my first delegation. I realized I needed to join a spiritual Jewish community, not just be a member of JVP, but part of something a little more institutional.
Don't assume people know what you're talking about. So Kehila is
Jewish. Yeah, Kehila is a synagogue in Piedmont, which in the 80s was started to promote the idea of dialogue with Palestinians in part, you know, and it's a very good social justice synagogue. But there's still Zionism there too. But they do allow us as a Havara for a Free Palestine, which is a group there, which is explicitly anti-Zionist. So it does allow us to be in its space. And that's hard for some of its members, but the leadership stands up for us to be a presence there. I'm also a member of Tzedek Chicago with great online resources and services, Rabbi Brant Rosen. And that recently changed on a board and membership level from being a non-Zionist to an actually anti-Zionist congregation. You know, so they're few and far between. Jewish Voice for Peace does have a Havara network where Jews around the country are creating more, you know, ritual that is meaningful in an anti-occupation way, and in some cases even anti-Zionist. If, because there are rabbis that were writing against Zionism back 100 years ago, and so lifting those voices up is also helpful.
All right. I'd like you to tell us about your event tomorrow. And
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. At 10 o'clock tomorrow morning that I am doing a report back, which will follow more of the threads from, you know, the last 6 years, but also more images and video of some of the things that I saw on this last trip, and seeing a little bit of evolution over the last several years. So that's going to be from 10 to 11:30. And so far signed up is a pretty interesting mix of people I know from different walks of life. So it's not going to be one thing. There'll be times for discussion for people, plus me doing report, and then a little bit of chance to for people to meet and connect to.
Yeah, and that link is at the tangents.com playlist in the Gaza Corner section for the Zoom invite. Or you can just email Jim. Jim also has a missive he sends out approximately every month. And Jim's email is haber.jim at gmail.com.